All right. Good morning. I said good morning. Excellent. Good. Thank you. My name is Andre Campbell. I'm a trauma surgeon, general surgeon. I work at the University of California, San Francisco. And what I thought we'd do, since we actually all our speakers, can we just give them a round of applause, please, for our speakers? Excellent job. We were just remarking everybody actually was on time. That's great. So I have no disclosures, but I just have some questions as we start things off, because what we want to do is, after we have some, I have some questions, we'll get through these, and then I'm sure you have some also. So you've heard a lot of different perspectives. You have 4 years, 3 years, why arguments for that. So I know that, Travis, you have an opinion about this. What is medical school going to look like in 10 years? We'll start with you, since you think everybody should go 3 years, right, and not 4 years like everybody else is doing.
I didn't say everybody. I didn't say everybody.
To some people.
Some people. And
how do you figure out who these some people are?
I think that's a challenge. But I tell you what, I think that, well, 10 years, quite honestly, is not very long. So I'm afraid we're not going to be too much further along than we should be, you know, in 10 years. But I do think that we are moving towards a competency-based approach. I think there are people that are very interested in this. And I think that we should be able to provide more of our students, not probably every single one, but I think we can tailor the educational experience to more of our students than we are right now. I think one of the other real interesting aspects, and it was mentioned by one of the speakers about all of the various competencies that we are making sure that our students achieve at this time compared to just medical knowledge or technical skills back in the day. I think one of the very interesting things is those competencies have just exploded in their importance. And I do believe that, let me go on a rant here for a second. Technology is taking over. So I have forgotten more information on medical knowledge than I could have ever imagined. But you know what? I sound smart pretty often because I can pull it up on my phone. And so I think that as we move forward, you're going to see artificial intelligence taking over more and more of what we consider just part of our daily lives. And what we are going to have to assure to stay relevant is that we continue to provide a direct patient contact with empathy, being able to communicate, being able to help people make decisions rather than just being a computer. And so I think that the focus of medical school is going to continue to change as we continue on. And in 10 to 15 years, I do believe the content will be very different.
Comments from the other members of the panel?
Oh, first, I have to make a disclaimer. I was in a three-year program, and I took a year of research, so I ended up in 4 years. But I think the point, I think, in the next 10 years is very clear. As we look at precision medicine, all of us within the next 5 years are probably going to have a complete DNA component that our primary care physicians will know. And at least they'll have some ideas what genes we're carrying that might be bad. Now let's take that to the educational world. One of the things I've learned in my return to education is the difference between auditory and visual learners, for example. I think what will happen is that we are going to individualize the education. Currently, what we do is we give mass production. In my day, you slept through many of the lectures as you were there. I got some of the best sleep time I ever got on a Wednesday afternoon on one professor. But what happens now is our students have podcasts. If they're people that are afternoon people, they can watch the podcast. They can watch it twice as fast. They can watch it twice. They can do other things so that their own personal learning style is optimized. So I think that's what's going to happen certainly sooner in the next 5 years, that we're going to personalize the education based on the ability of the student to learn. And I know we learn quite a few things of deficits. We have extremely bright students nowadays, but they do have some different learning styles that are compatible or not compatible. Best example I have is, I call them the electrical engineers, mechanical engineers. They are taught to solve a problem. They grab a book. They get the resources. I have to convince them, a few of them, in the first month, you got to memorize. There are certain things you have to know. You got to know anatomy, certainly, for sure. That's not going to change. Thank God. In the last, that's probably the only thing in my training that's still there. We haven't changed in anatomy. But you have to know what the style is of the learner so that they can adapt to this new medical education. So my big thing for the next 10 years, I think, will be the what I call precision education, or an evaluation. Right now we're working just with the strugglers, but we'll be working with all the students to figure out what's their best way to learn this material and what's the speed that they learn it. Some of them learn certain modules very quickly, others don't. And so we need to adjust our education so that in the end they all have the same product in terms of things, but to get there will be variable times and variable approaches. Thank you.
So I want the other panelists to comment too, but do you think that we have the fidelity now to drill down to each student to figure out what their learning DNA is so that we can know what kind of education you should get? Because I don't think I have that now. You may have it at the Ohio State University.
Maybe have it
in Wisconsin, but I don't have it in San Francisco.
And I'd like to elaborate on that too. When Dr. Webb was presenting on these third years, I'm part of a school that was initially an accelerated baccalaureate program. So these young geniuses with very few life experiences were taken out of high school, immediately started college, did all of college in 2 years, so there was no liberal arts component, nothing but the sciences, very much of a bubble, dropped into medical school as long as they got a particular MCAT score and grade point. We're getting away from that because especially, not to be biased, but especially the young men, they wouldn't know a nonverbal cue if it hit them over the head. You know, their entire life has been on their phones, and when they've had very few life experiences, they are not ready to be physicians. So what is your assessment of your students before you take them in to this type of program? I just sat there thinking, oh my God, they not only need to know what they're into, but they're getting ready for the match in their second year. So
they're already panicked in the third year.
I have another.
And they want to do an extra year. Right?
So I have another disclosure. One of my younger brothers is one of those nerds who graduated from that. And it took him probably the first 3 to 5 years of his practice setting to really realize what the human and emotional character was, because he was one of those people that went through school in 6 years and did not have much in the humanities. And it was difficult for him to really adjust to those aspects. So I agree. Well, let's look at, to answer your question about are we going to know everybody, my answer is yes. How soon, I don't know. But let's look at the students that have problems. One thing about medical school, I always tell the students, the ones that are really nervous when they start, very few people do not complete. At our school, we lose probably 2 to 3 students a year out of 200. Why? Because we put a big emphasis on looking at deficits to bring them up to that level. So right now we're emphasizing and trying to find out what are the deficits that aren't making success amongst the candidates. We assume as a baseline, because of the competition and our choice, that all the students are extremely able to complete the curriculum. We don't take somebody and say, well, the Germans take 2,000 people, and by the third year, they've cut them down to roughly 400 to 500. So they take an opposite approach. In America, probably due to the expense, we take people and we guarantee their success. And we currently do, if you think of your medical school committees that you meet, and you meet one-to-one with a student, what's your problem? Is this an emotional problem? Is this a mental health problem? Is this a learning disability? So we do that functionally now, but I say that we're probably going to be projecting and learning. And the place that we learned this, I learned this when I was a Harvard Macy's fellow, the educators are already looking at this aspect. They are analyzing to death how people learn. And in surgery, for example, there wasn't that. We've always thought it's an apprenticeship and that's it. But we are now learning that it's not more than just your hands, it's your head that we have to look at, and how you look at things may be different in the way you learn, but you still learn the same material. So I think we will bounce along. And the best example is the Google example. I always ask, it used to be I'd ask the students what the answer was to one of my vague questions, and then I'd say phone a friend, and they'd pull up a Google and that would bring the answer. That access to material makes a different type of learning style. I don't have to know the most current dosage for a drug. I ask my pharmacist. I used to have to look it up in the PDR. I can get that information instantaneously. That's the same example in education. What are the fundamental things to teach a student to get the resources to achieve that level one when they complete? And I do think that we will eventually, amongst all students, not just the ones that are having trouble, figure out what's their best learning style, how can they assimilate the material, what areas are problems, are we presenting it incorrectly on a block basis?
Shema, you want to comment? Because you've
yeah.
spent time, got a master's education, you're an expert.
Yeah.
Mostly the master's tells you, shows you what you don't know, and then it stops. And then if you really want to know what you don't know, you got to get a PhD, I think, which I did not do. But no, the only thing I would add is if I were to place money down on something that will change, I would bet that over 10 to 20 years we'll probably have more in a professional education. That's my suspicion. I think that none of my medical students go to class. They all go to lecture capture and watch it at 1.5 speed, which I didn't know was a thing.
At Starbucks, I thought, with a latte when I drank it.
Right. I mean, I thought I already spoke at 1.5 speed, but apparently I could speak faster, and that's how they listen to their lectures. So the first time they kind of interact in group sessions and taking care of patients on the clerkship, we're really asking a lot of them. And I think there's been some really cool moves made towards integrating other professional fields like nursing or pharmacy or social work or case management or even healthcare administration into the education of medical students that will probably serve them really well when they start needing to practice.
Okay. Yeah, medical students, right?
So I'm willing to meet you halfway. So I see in 10 years a bimodal distribution and more programs that are willing to attempt the three-year structure, but I also see a lot of my colleagues taking more and more and more time in between. I took one research year, I go to a conference, oh, you're gonna apply to an integrated program with 1 year of research? Now everyone's taking 2 years of research. And so I just find it would be extremely challenging for many students to really develop their professional and research portfolios by the end of MS2 and apply to these programs. So I think we need to address the elephant in the room, and that if we're going to be looking at remodeling and integrating these medical school curricula, we have to think about what the selection criteria is like for residency and how we can make sure that those things are still moving smoothly so that people that are interested in a three-year program and do want to apply to smaller matches are able to do so.
Next question is, we can go down the line, is what have we learned from our failed experiments with the changes in our curriculum? I mean, it sounds like you've had some successes.
I've had
failures.
Some failures.
You want to go?
Yeah. Failure. Failure was we moved from 2 years of preclinical to 1.5 years of preclinical. I think a lot of medical schools have done that. And that was a disaster because basically faculty took 150 PowerPoint slides that used to deliver in 4 hours, and then they delivered it in two. And then asked the med students to just look at the rest of the PowerPoint slides at home, and that they were responsible for that material. So we did sort of exactly what you had referred to, which is we didn't do a good enough job of getting the faculty on board with that idea of culling, the various biochemistry pathways that I've jettisoned from my brain. I think that is huge if you're going to try to do any experimentation. Like everybody needs to be on board, which could, like you said, take years.
I like to tell one story, and that is with the podcast. All of our students, by the end of the first year, I would say only 20 or 25% come to class. I've had two students in the last 10 years who became nocturnists. They're going to be the perfect practitioners for the night work. Both of them had difficulty when during the end of the second year they had to show up on Wednesday morning to see some patients at 9 o'clock because they would sleep all day and then study all night where it's nice and quiet, and they did extremely well, but they had difficulty in switching their sleep cycles. In fact, one of them I had to send to a sleep specialist so that we could convert him over a week back to daytime work. Now he's a radiology resident, so he's back in the nighttime again. So whether it's day or night.
He's the perfect nighthawk radiologist.
Absolutely. Right? But I think what we need to do is be aware Because oftentimes students are afraid to talk to faculty until they have a problem. And it's, I think, one of the things that we need to figure out is a way to figure out what failures may be happening and get to them early before they've failed an exam, before they've had difficulty showing up for a 9 o'clock patient two or three times. Those are really the things that we need to look at. We often assume, because we're so brilliant, that we get this new curriculum, that it's going to be great, everybody's going to do well. And then we look at our great successes, but we often don't look at the failures or look at them early enough to see what the problems might be. And I think that's where we need to really work and put our emphasis on the changes.
So I just want to highlight a failure that we had. Yeah. And I want to highlight what failed, because it wasn't the learners. And I challenge all of us to think back and figure a time when the learners actually failed. One of the areas that we failed in was we've been trying to integrate both horizontally and vertically our curricular content much better. And we really tried to do that during our third year with multiple clerkship directors. So who do you think failed? The clerkship directors got tired of it, didn't like to have to coordinate and work together and put all this work in place to run these small workshops with the students. And so it comes back to faculty buy-in, getting them to recognize that they don't have to do everything and really start to focus on what needs to be taught and how to teach it. So I look in the mirror when I'm looking for failure, because it's generally my fault and my colleagues, and I don't put it on the students. The students, you give the students expectations and these students will rise to meet them. And so that's why I believe that most of the innovation, most of the issues are within us to actually meet the students' needs. And so that's why I worry about the 10-year time period, because I know that we are just extremely stubborn and slow in our ability to rise to meet the challenge.
And we resist change.
We resist change. We want change, but we don't want to change.
That's right.
Right? We want change, but we don't want to change. And this is the biggest problem that we have.
Now, I'd like, we have a microphone here. If anybody in the audience have questions, please come. Please step up to the microphone and please come. Oh, it looks like everybody's coming up. Come on down. Outstanding. Come on. You have at it, please. Thank you.
Well, first of all, I'd like to congratulate all the members of the panel for taking time from their busy surgical schedules to pursue what I believe is our greatest challenge, which is to create the next crop of educators and physicians. I'm currently the dean at the Medical School at the University of Puerto Rico, and I believe that as a dean, I have to deliver a product. And I like the idea of quality, because to me, a quality product is a physician who is not only knowledgeable and clinically competent, but who's also ethical, who has great communication skills, who's an excellent problem solver, and who is socially aware. And I think that, unfortunately, the metrics that we have to get medical schools into the medical, to get students into medical school, focus too much on knowledge, on basic knowledge like biology, biochemistry, and whatnot. And that could lead to success in the first 2 years of medical school, but not necessarily will mean success as a clinical physician. I congratulate Dr. Lindsay for taking the year that he didn't take in medical school to do research. I think research is essential. I did 2 years of surgical research when I was up here in Boston doing my surgical residency, and what research taught me was to think. I think we need physicians who can think critically, because after all, what we do every day is to solve problems. We don't need physicians who can memorize a lot of material. We need physicians who can take that material, integrate it, and apply it to solve the problems that we're presented with every day. And to do so, knowing that people come from different walks of life, and if we cannot relate to them as human beings, we're not going to be very successful at getting the information we need to help them solve their problems. Okay. That's my comment.
Thank you. Thank you for your
comments.
You. Next question.
Can I comment real quickly just
yes.
to,
yes.
because I know the question was asked, how in the world are we figuring out who should be coming to our medical schools?
Yeah.
So if, you know, this isn't necessarily an admissions panel, but the world of admissions is really getting interesting. And one of the things, so we do some emotional intelligence and testing. We have talked about doing escape rooms. Anybody know what that is?
Yeah.
So no, there not, and there
not,
are
you stress them out during the interview.
Yes.
You put them in a room they can't
and
get out.
And there are medical schools that are doing this right now. There are medical schools doing this right now where they put three or four applicants into a room. They give them a problem. They give them, and it's a challenging situation. They don't know each other at all, and they have to come up with some sort of solution to get out of the room. And there are, it is interesting.
Well,
it's
cooperation,
yes.
And critical
it has nothing to. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I appreciate it, and that's exactly right. And so, those are the qualities that we need to look at much more than just how they're doing on the MCAT or whatever exam that they're doing.
Next question.
Thank you.
Thank
yeah,
you.
Hi, I'm Margaret Dunn. I'm the dean of the medical school at Wright State in Dayton, and I have a comment and I have a question. My comment is just, I mean, yes, what you said. I mean, I think if you consider now how the role of librarians have changed. You know, it is a totally different job. I mean, it's to help people ask questions and find information. And then, of course, what we're asking physicians to do further is apply that information. I did our original problem-based piece in our curriculum when I was chair of our curriculum committee 20 years ago, and I remember setting up 10 rooms with textbooks, I remember getting 10 copies of, you know, Schwartz and 10 copies of Harrison and putting them in rooms to do problem-based learning. And now I've been teaching a problem-based group in our school now, and I mean, it's like, you're just saying, no, we're not Googling during this session, you're just coming up with a differential. Like, now I'm trying to keep them from doing that, so it's a completely different game now. But I would say, to your point, generally speaking, I agree with you completely about when students don't succeed, it's on us. But I have noticed in the new curriculum that we've been running for 2 years where we have no lectures. So they have up to 4 hours of scheduled time a day, and it's all group work. It's problem-based learning, it's team-based learning, it's peer instruction, that even though we're absolutely clear during our admissions process and our applicants spend a lot of time talking to our students, we still have people that, well, aren't you just going to tell us what we need to know? I mean, where's the lecture? So when the first year we rolled this out, we had students that had never had a read for comprehension. I mean, they had no experience of looking at it. They never read a textbook in college. So they had no idea of how to take a bite of information. And so we've had to engineer a lot of features for academic stress. So if you do new pedagogy, and my faculty are totally on it, but you're taking students from higher ed where they've had no experience of it, it is something you have to work on. But my question for you, and then you can comment, is
who do you want to ask?
I'm talking.
You mean the guy with the beard down there?
Not that beard over there.
No, I am talking with my faculty about bringing on a three-year curriculum where it will track into our family. You know, you'll get acceptance, attentive acceptance into our family medicine program.
Sure.
And so I'm interested in your experience about, yes, who do you admit to these kind of tracks and who do you matriculate? I'm interested in your experience there.
Yeah, so generally our students are coming from Wisconsin. Our regional campuses are up in, like I said, Green Bay, and then in Wausau, which is up in central Wisconsin. So we're trying to get, you know, 98% Wisconsinites. We're trying to get people who have done their college experience somewhere in Wisconsin, somewhere even in the area. The UW system has schools all over the place. And so we're really looking for individuals who we think will stay in the region. stay in Wisconsin doing primary care in particular. The challenge is that we're a little short on our applicants, on our good applicants. We don't want, I'll be quite honest, we don't want the superstar researcher that's gone to Harvard, because that individual will not stay in primary care, will not stay in small town Wisconsin. We're looking for a lot of opportunities come from people who have already been in healthcare in some setting. So nurses, nurse practitioners, EMTs, whatever. Somebody who may be a little bit older, may be a little more mature, have some experience already, and have a clear focus on what they want to do.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, we have 5 more minutes, so let's step up and ask a question, please.
With Detroit. I enjoyed the panel. At the end, we have to remember that our medical students are really looking for a job when they're done. And I find all too often the fourth year is used to find a job. So first of all, they're going to take a month off to study for their step 2 exam so they get a high score so they can get a good job, and then they're going to do 3 electives away somewhere in orthopedics, for example, and then when they don't match and they end up on my service in their preliminary year, they don't know how to treat diabetes or hypertension. So I
agree.
I'm very impressed, Dr. Lindsay, with your approach with this, and I'm wondering if you have 44 students that you're really looking after. What's the number that one faculty could possibly handle? Because I assume you're the one who says to this young guy, you don't belong in orthopedics.
Yes, it is difficult, and that's one of the reasons I put the challenge out to people to do this. I'm an older guy who came back to education. That's my life. I love to do surgery. I continue to do surgery. But I think it's very important that I convince my colleagues that we need to spend time doing this. When the students come to me, I call when their orthopedics is their intention, I tell them 2 things. One, either your scores aren't close, 78% of US graduates match, 22% do not. You have to have some other alternative in your list of your applications, because there's a 1 in 5 chance you're not gonna match. 2, you have to do job interviews. Those are not outside rotations, those are job interviews. That's the only specialty in which that's very clear. Most, I also approve all of the out rotations, so I get the information, I call the director, find out what they're gonna do for the month, make sure that they're gonna fill out the evaluation, because that's one of the biggest problems, trying to get an evaluation from an outside. If it's inside my institution, it's easy. I call the dean, he says, you want your salary dinged or you're gonna get this assessment done. But if it's an outside one, they can't get it. Yes, it's a lot of work. It is my passion. That's why I came back. Certainly, at this point in my life, I'm able to do it. I have some conflict with the IRVU system sometimes, and I have to do extra things. I was in practice, so I know how to work that system enough to make it up again. But what I'm trying to do is find others like myself who make a portion of their career, and we're working on a learning RVU so that they are compensated appropriately. One of the things, I got an award with this tie at the first week of October, and the American College now has a good, wonderful academy for master surgeon educators. I would encourage anyone mid-career beyond who are interested to join us or apply for it. We are trying to push education to the same level as research and clinical. That's been my goal for the last 11 years when I returned from practice to education.
So we just have a little bit more time. We have a couple quick questions.
Ahead. Yeah, I just Toby Talley. I'm the clerkship director at Athens, Georgia campus of MCG. I want to echo something that Dr. Gant said earlier. It's one of my biggest concerns is the maturation and development of the medical students. I also teach in the first year. I spend 10 hours a week with the first year students. They don't know that we need to give them more opportunities. To figure out, to see the different specialties and figure out what they want to do, because we're asking them in the middle of the second year to declare what they want to do. They don't know. They haven't seen most of the rotations, and they don't even do emergency medicine until fourth year. So what if they think that's what they think they want to do, and then they get there and they say, no, this isn't what I want to do.
So you have a quick question or not?
No, that's just my comment.
Next. We're up past our time.
I'll try to be quick. I'm Doug Cassidy. I'm a resident at Mass General right now, doing research in surgical education. I just wanted to quickly ask about the fourth year, specifically what Dr. Lindsay was talking about with the kind of division based on subspecialty. I imagine that took a lot of manpower and buy-in in order to do. Do you think the responsibility lies at the level of each individual medical school to do that, or if it's something that should be done nationally? And then in addition, do you think it's kind of the onus should be also on the residency after the match to make sure that applicants or their incoming residents are prepared beforehand while they're finishing up medical school?
A quick answer.
Why don't let somebody else answer that? You want to answer that?
That was a really multi-part question, I guess. There's a lot of good information out there that's published by each of the professional societies, which is probably what has been used at other schools if you want information about what should be in that curriculum. So if you are, going to be a certain type of doctor, you don't have to sort of make it up as you go along. So you could use that as a professional reference point and say to your colleagues, look, this is the nationally published standard. Getting the buy-in, though, I mean, I obviously listed that as one of my failures. So I'm not sure I can speak to how you could do it better other than to emphasize the fact that it's critical if you're going to succeed.
One last question, and we're done.
Thanks, I'll make this quick. Hi, I'm Katarina Chang. I'm a medical student at the University of Massachusetts, currently on a research year prior to my fourth year. One of the biggest issues I've noticed all throughout medical school and the whole application process is like what I consider a financial weeding out at every stage. So by the time you get to medical school, the vast majority of medical students are from these highly, frankly, wealthy families. And I think there's a great divide in life experiences in people who have different levels of privilege. So how do you agree with that? What is your perspective on, like, you were commenting on life experiences and the differences, and people who actually have connections to the community, I think, are not able to enter medical school.
I know we only have like 20 seconds. Sorry. What I'd say is that NYU's aspiration to create more primary care providers by offsetting 100% of their tuition is an interesting experiment. I'm not sure that's going to succeed. I think somebody, gave me a bunch of money, I would still become a general surgeon. I think what it will do, though, is open the doors for more diversity, socioeconomic and otherwise. I think that is an excellent experiment and potentially, can succeed a little bit there.
Yeah. Speaking of like, what's going to medical school look like in 10 years? I'd be interested to see how people address this issue, because frankly, myself and many of my fellow students at the University of Massachusetts chose that school because tuition is less than half the price of others. Thank you.
Very wise.
So I'd like to thank all the audience for asking all the questions. Also, I'd like to thank the panelists and my co-moderator, Dr. Gann, for doing an excellent panel.